And I'm usually over at the Chinatown campus. It's a kind of a treat to be able to come over here and worship with you guys for a bit. We're sort of in a series about what does it mean to be close with Jesus. And we've been taking a look particularly at the disciple Judas, whom Christians will mention with a hiss and a spit when they mention his name. But what is it about Judas that got him so close to Jesus, but at the same time, not close with Jesus in heart? And today we're going to talk about what is one of the things that when you are close with Jesus, what does it change in terms of your view of values? What's worthy? What's worthwhile? The title on this sermon is Wasted and Worth It, not because we're talking about a great time in town that was later on worth it, but it was really about what is it that you might consider a waste, but Jesus would not consider it a waste. And that's what we're talking about today, because when we're thinking about so this kind of exciting time of year, we're going on prayer walks. Good Friday's coming up soon, and we've got graduations coming around just around the corner, and things are warming. My favorite pastimes, which is hiking, which I used to do a lot more before I had kids. Hiking, I used to do that with some friends, and we'd do some overnighters. We'd go to Vermont and go out there. One of the best parts of hiking is preparing your food, packing your pack, and getting just this particular kind of hiking food that you have. There's the trail mix that you bring, and then my favorite, which is beef jerky. Beef jerky is it comes in these pouches, right? And so I got this pemmican beef jerky. My friend and I were hiking someplace in Vermont. It was overnighter, and we were saving it for a time when we really needed it. It was a big bag of beef jerky, but we knew we would finish it before the end of the hike. So we're hiking, and it's getting hot. It's the second day, and we're just... We need to pick me up. We know now's the time. So we stop, we take a break, we sit down on a rock. I take out the pemmican, which I got, I think it was from Costco. I try to open it. I can't open it. I don't have a scissors with me. I probably should have realized I could use something else, like a tool or something that I brought with me. But I'm pulling it. And you know those bags that just won't open? So I pull it so hard, and finally I yank, and the whole thing just scatters into the wilderness. What a waste. Look at that, and you know what a waste is. A waste is something, it could have been for something so good, but now it's for nothing. And that's how I felt at that moment. There's other times in life when people might tell you that something is a waste. So, for example, my household, growing up, we would never turn the radiator higher than like 63 degrees because we did not want to waste the gas. And 63 degrees was good enough, even though I argued, Mom, they tell us that room temperature is 72 degrees. And nope, 63 is good enough. Don't waste it. Okay, and there are other things that might be considered a waste. So, for example, maybe some of you guys have felt this before. I've got this education in a certain thing, and I didn't end up going into that field. And some folks might say to you, or you might think it yourself, that was kind of a waste. It could have been good for something, but it didn't end up being good for anything. And a waste is what we're talking about today, because one of the things that changes when you're close with Jesus is how you view what's worth it, whether something is worth it or if it's a waste. So, for example, if I'm a fisherman, right, and I love fishing, not as much as I used to, once again, because I have kids. Kids are wonderful, by the way. I like them. They're great. Somebody might look at a fly rod that my wife got me for my for a wedding present, and it was the fly rod and reel combo together was $400, and I admit to this great sin of extravagance. But the amazing fly rod, which I still use to this day whenever I can. Now, whenever I go and I admit it to people, and I'm admitting it to you now, and you can judge me all you want, because you have something that's like this that I can judge you on. Jesus wouldn't have us judge each other. But whenever I tell people about this, they'll think, oh my goodness, you wasted that amount of money on a fishing rod. I could go to Walmart and I could buy the fishing rod and it would cost me $40. You spent 10 times as much. Do the fish taste better? when you're a fisherman, it starts to take on an air of something that's more worth it. Because you use this thing all the time, because you know its value, you know what it is, and the things that it does well, the things that it doesn't do well, right? And same as if you're a chef, you know, using plain old mushrooms versus like premium mushrooms, certain kind of spices versus not using the spices, substitutions of certain kinds of flour, they become more valuable. And in a certain way, in the same way, when you walk close with Jesus, what you value tends to change. Where once you saw something as wasteful, you could see it as worth it. And we're going to pick it up right now in the passage that we just read. It's 6 days before Passover. And this is really a showdown between two points of view, between Mary and between Judas. Mary is the sister, the younger sister, we presume, of Lazarus and Martha. And Jesus is close to Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And as a matter of fact, it says here that as Jesus comes in, this whole thing is in the shadow of what has happened not too long ago, which is Jesus came to town when Lazarus was sick. This is the last sign in the book of signs in John, which is the first half of the book of John. And the culminating sign that shows Jesus, that shows everyone who Jesus is the raising of Lazarus. Jesus comes to town, everyone's sad. Mary can't do anything but cry. Martha said, if you had been here, but I believe in the resurrection and stuff like that, but if you had been here, it would have been different. And Jesus cries, and then Jesus proceeds to raise Lazarus from the dead. Something nobody had ever seen before. Something nobody ever expected. So this whole thing is in the shadow of this. And at that moment that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, people were starting to plot against him. The authorities were plotting against him because this was getting out of hand. Everyone was following him. So Jesus and his disciples withdrew to the edge of the desert and lived there for a little while. And everyone wondered, will Jesus come back? And Passover is coming. And so they're coming. So everyone's wondering, is Jesus coming back for Passover into Jerusalem? And this is the last time Jesus is going to come into Jerusalem. He marches in, and the talk around town is, will he be here there? Will he won't? What's going to happen? And of course, a few day later is going to be the triumphal entry. But at this moment, Jesus comes and he stops in at Bethany in the shadow of what he's just done a little while ago in the same town to Lazarus. And Lazarus is there. They're sitting around the table and Martha is serving and Mary's there. And they're having a great time. They are so thankful. And this is one of the things that changes first. When we are close with Jesus, we take a look at what he's done for us, and that takes on a whole new flavor in terms of what comes next. The raising of Lazarus. For Lazarus himself, he's sitting there, and for him, he's enjoying being alive. I'm so glad to be alive. I was dead, now I'm not. I stunk, now I stink less. And Martha's there serving, and Mary's there, and she's about to pour out her gratitude too. Right. So going on from there, they gave him a dinner. And so this is where they appreciate Jesus. They give him a dinner and Mary shows up. And the first thing that anybody has an inclination of something different going on is probably they sniff the air. What is that? That's nice. And then they look around, they see something actually they totally don't expect, which is culturally just messed up and wrong. This young woman just kneeling over with hair undone. And she's wiping Jesus' feet, and she has poured this nard, this perfume, on Jesus. And of course, the first thing that everyone's thinking is, first of all, this is outrageous. Because there's this cultural taboo there, which it says this: if you are a woman, one of your crowning glories is your hair. Keep it nice, keep it up, but keep it hidden because that's not for the world to see. Okay? It's immodest. And so she's down there being culturally immodest, right? And also, she is using the cleanest part of her body, which is her hair. The most beautiful part, the part that symbolizes pride, status, everything. And she's wiping it on Jesus' feet. It's a ridiculous looking scene. Because I think it was probably more ridiculous to them than it would be even to us. And to us, it would seem pretty ridiculous as we're looking at that, right? Because what is she doing? Doesn't she have any self-pride? Doesn't she have any sense of propriety? Like, she's a pariah. She just made herself a laughingstock. But Mary didn't care about that. Because as they go on, and as that perfume is poured, the real worth of that act is shown. And that's actually spoken by Judas. Judas says, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He kind of utters something that everyone else is thinking, okay? But later on, the narrator shows us that Judas actually didn't think of this at all. It's just something that he said. And we'll talk about what that means in a little bit. But Judas speaks up. He says, this thing's worth 300 denarii. And so now we have to take a look at something that the writer focuses on a lot, which is, how much was this perfume worth? This perfume was worth a lot more than a $400 fishing rod. This perfume was 300 denarii. It talked about the quality of it too, where he could use just one word, perfume. The narrator uses four words. It's like seven words in English, but he uses four words. He uses the word expensive. He uses the word perfume. He uses nard, ointment. And then one word that people don't really know what it refers to, the word is pistic, which is either faithful or pure. Here it's translated pure. And people think, well, maybe it has to do with like how that kind of perfume was marketed. Like that's the name for it, something like eau de toilette or something like that, or eau de parfum. So they're listening, they're looking at it, they're smelling it, they're seeing it. And this thing is ridiculously expensive. 300 denarii. So a denarius is one day's worth of a normal wage. Okay, so 300 denarii were 300 days worth of wage. You could translate that to something like, maybe in our modern day value, $17,000. $17,000 right there. You know, when the Red Sox won the World Series, not this past time, but the time before, one of the things that made me just stop and like, I was floored when I saw this, when I read about this. One of the Sox players, David Ortiz, took this champagne bottle that was worth $250,000. In the celebration, they won the World Series, and so they open it, and he's spraying it everywhere. And then he downs part of it, and then sprays the rest of it, and he enjoys it with the rest of his teammates by showering them. Oh my goodness, he just drank a house. What is this waste? And I think if you were there, you would probably have thought the same thing. Perfume back then was kept for a couple things. One of them, it is just for the value of it, like a collector's thing. It was kept also as embalming. Another thing, it could be for using a little bit at a time. But she used the whole entire pound of the thing. You could think like a Coke bottle's worth, and poured it out onto him, onto his feet. Probably other places too, because that would be a ton for just the feet. But that's a lot. And here's the thing, once you use it, it's gone. In my house, we have a lot of glow sticks. You know what glow sticks are for Halloween, right? I don't know why I have this thing too. Like, I don't want to use them. Like, I have them, I have a bunch of them. And sometimes maybe my daughter asks me, hey, can we play with glow stick? And I was like, well, if you use it, then it's going to be gone. And you won't be able to use it anymore. And that's true of this sacrifice. And there are some things that you can give. You can give once, and then they are gone. You better use it well. You better choose what you use it for really well. And Judas doesn't see it as worth it. He says, this is not worth it. Why? Mary, you see her devotion. She loves Jesus, right? She sees it as worth it because Lazarus has been raised. If Lazarus wasn't here, her life would be, in a sense, over too. Because in those days, women were particularly vulnerable. And if you lose the protector, and father didn't seem to be in the picture, mother didn't seem to be in the picture anyway here, then Martha and Mary, their lives were over. So she is extremely grateful to Jesus, not just because she got back somebody that she loved, but also because, in a sense, Jesus has restored the life that she had. What was dead was back alive. And so Mary poured out everything to him. Everything. Even her self-dignity, even her pride, even her hair, even her perfume. What was that perfume for anyway? Some folks would say, well, they're not poor folks, but they're not rich people either. It doesn't look like they're rich. Why would they have such an expensive bottle of perfume? And some folks would say, there's at least a hint that it could have been for a dowry. Well, whether or not it was, there's a chance that this $17,000 worth of perfume could have represented her future. And she's pointing that out for Jesus too. What does Judas not get? See, when you look at Judas, his characterization is he's been with Jesus this whole time, really close to Jesus. And he's heard everything that Jesus preached. And maybe he even cast out demons. Maybe he even healed people. So can you follow Jesus and be close to Jesus and serve in ministry and things like that and actually not get close to the heart of Jesus? And I think the Bible leads us to say, maybe. How? In one particular way, Judas, and I think there's a bit of this in all of us, is a bit of a scorekeeper, if you will. You know, a scorekeeper is somebody who needs to make sure the score is even at all times. So maybe it's you go out to eat, and then if you go out to eat several times, you treat somebody. If you're a scorekeeper, you'll remember that other person didn't ever contribute their fair share. A scorekeeper is somebody who looks at things in terms of dollars and cents. And you and I know that relationships are not about dollars and cents, and following Jesus is obviously not about dollars and cents, though faithfulness with finances and things like that is very, very important, right? But it's not about keeping things even. But there's a sense here that Judas sort of is that way. He, in a couple ways. One, with money. Two, with how he sees himself. And then third, with how he sees Jesus himself. So let's kind of crack into that. How does he see money? Judas always has money attached to his name. Iscariot does not mean money. But you take a look at what did Judas do before he was a disciple. In this passage here, there's the word thief. That's slightly misleading because you'll take that and you'll conclude something like Judas was a thief before he met Jesus. Jesus came, redeemed him, and he's no longer a thief, except really he is a thief still. I don't think that's the sense of this. As a matter of fact, it goes on to talk about how Jesus is the money keeper, the guy who held the money bag. Now, why on earth would Jesus give the money bag to a thief? And why would the disciple stand for it? There's a good chance that he gave Judas the money bag because he was known as somebody who could handle finances. There's a good chance, respected fellow, maybe merchant class or something like that. So he knows money. And he thinks about money, and the things that kind of motivate him are money. Because what's behind his statement of why was this not sold for 300 denarii? Well, he knew the value of, by the way, of the perfume. So he thought about it a lot. He looked at it in his eyes, like, ka-ching. And when she poured it out, you can see the ka-ching money sign drain from his cartoon eyes, and crying or whatever. But his statement that it's 300 denarii should have been given to the poor is really because he wanted some of that money. He wanted some of it. Now, what's the next time that we see Judas associated with money? He sells Jesus for money. He sells Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Mary gives up 300 denarii of perfume for Jesus, all in one moment. And Judas sells his whole 3 years' worth of ministry with Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Money is on his mind. It's something that matters to him. And here's the thing. Your classic sermon will say, beware of the evil of money and things like that. But there is a way in which money, if we let it kind of get in there as a primary motivator for us, it becomes a driving factor in our lives. And you start to see everything in terms of the ka-ching value. And who hasn't had this moment where you're thinking about giving a gift to somebody, it's their wedding, and you're thinking, well, what's my budget for weddings? I have that conversation with my wife often. It's like, okay, is it going to be this amount or this amount? Okay, how much are they worth to us? And I hate that conversation. But at the same time, sometimes I feel like, oh, there's so many practical reasons I have to have that conversation, but it's the worst conversation to have because I'm trying to, how do I quantify my friendship with my friends. You should feel that tension if you have that conversation. It's good to have that tension. But here, Mary doesn't have that tension because she gives it all up. Not saying that's what everyone should do, particularly because at this moment, Jesus drives home that this is a specific, important moment in history when he's here. Okay, and that's why when Judas says, well, why? What about the poor? What about, and other people think that too, even though Judas doesn't really think it. When they think, what about the poor? Jesus says, the poor you'll always have with you, but you don't always have me. And he points to there's something much more valuable here than even the poor. You think about that. Hundreds of thousands of people maybe around Israel who could have used money from that. How much could that have done? And Jesus actually has the gall to say, Judas, believe it or not, I'm worth it. Sounds arrogant, except that he's the Son of God. Sounds arrogant, except that he has raised the dead literally just a couple days ago. And sounds arrogant, except for the fact that in a couple days, he's going to give up everything for our sins. And so there's Judas. He's got money on his mind. He also thinks money in terms of himself. Money. He thinks of, he's money. He's a scorekeeper in terms of himself too. He looks at himself through the lens of how do I measure up? Where do we get that? If you take a look at what he said, in verse 6, the narrator tells you he said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. And having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put in it. You could put a couple things here together. One, Judas is not who he makes himself out to be. The inner Judas is different from the outer Judas. And for many of us, that's probably going to always, maybe, hopefully not always, but that's going to be consistently be true, that there's the inner us and there's outer us that doesn't quite match up. And we would love for Jesus to come, and we're praying and we're asking, and this is what sanctification is, where the inner us changes to the us that he wants us to be, right? But Judas puts up a front. And why does he do that? Because he needs others to think better of him. It's one of the things that drives him to be with Jesus. What can he hope to gain from being with Jesus? There's a couple things. A lot of people hope for a revolution, and with revolution, reward, right? That he could be one of the rulers. And when that becomes less likely, then Judas comes and he starts taking a little bit from the money bag. He's a thief, but he doesn't want to see himself as one. You can almost see him justifying himself. And I don't know if you've ever justified yourself this way. When I was younger, I used to justify I used to download pirated software and music. Sort of kind of the flavor of the day, right? And my excuse was, well, you know, they make so much anyway. My excuse was, everybody does it. And Judas kind of does the same thing here. He justifies himself for taking he probably doesn't take extravagant amounts. He takes a little bit, you know, maybe something here and there that he pockets a little bit. And he can probably justify it by saying, but we're doing so much good for the poor. It doesn't matter so much if I take a little bit. And so that's, he sees himself that way. He counts, he's a scorekeeper in that way. And in some ways, maybe even more because he looks at it and says, well, we've given so much, then I definitely measure up. And then the third way that he's a scorekeeper is also in how he looks at Jesus. You know, why is he following Jesus? Jesus should give something back to me. I should get something from this. And as he doesn't get it, he becomes increasingly frustrated. And you're going to see soon after this, after Jesus accepts this lavish perfume gift, Judas has decided. In the other Gospels, it is actually this moment that makes him go and sell out Jesus. Because he's done with Jesus. Jesus can't give back to me the way that I want. And this connects to us. You know, isn't there a part of us, maybe some of us, maybe all of us, definitely in me, that makes us scorekeepers? We don't want to waste anything, especially when it could come back to us. relationships are more than dollars and cents, but some of us do keep tabs, right? For some of us, we look at, for some of us, it really is a struggle if there is a certain salary being offered or another salary being offered, and you know that the circumstances around both, there's probably a better one, probably the one with the lower salary circumstance, better for your family, better for your health, better for whatever, but that dollar amount drives you hard. Or it's hard for us maybe to be generous with people sometimes. Because what's happening there, what sin is telling us, is that you can only trust the money. So if you don't have the money, there's nothing to trust. You can only trust the money, and if you don't have that, there's going to be nothing there to take care of you. Judas is one of those folks, and maybe for us that's something too. But maybe for us we're scorekeepers in different ways. Maybe it's not money, but it's maybe in friendships or relationships. Like, who's doing more in this friendship, in this relationship? Well, for me, it's in my marriage. You know, who's taking all the trash more? Who's cleaning the dirty diapers? Who's washing the dishes? I did that yesterday. Okay, so that means it's your turn now. You know, I was told by a very close mentor, you should never keep score. Because when you keep score, you divide the team. Right? And that's something that we do not just in marriage, but also in relationships and friendships amongst each other. But if it's not in relationships also, maybe it's in how you view yourself. Just as maybe Judas viewed himself, he needs to justify himself, and he needs to measure up, he needs to keep score with himself. And his way of keeping score is maybe in how he looks to other people, right? How do you present to people? Maybe for you guys, or maybe for all of us, it's keeping track of wins in life, or maybe in terms of experience, getting through certain milestones, like that's what really matters. Maybe for us, it's, you know, what position we have in the company, or what letters come after our name, or maybe who has a higher score on a test, who's in a better school. And it's like for many of us, look out here in a sea of a lot of folks with Asian heritage families. And for me, my upraising had a lot of comparison. And the comparisons is stuff like Cousin Jeffrey. Look at Cousin Jeffrey. I don't actually have a Cousin Jeffrey, by the way. Look at Cousin Jeffrey. You know, look at him. He got into famous school in Boston. Look at Cousin Jeffrey. He got a really good job. Look at Cousin Jeffrey. Why can't you be more like Cousin Jeffrey? Cousin Jeffrey bought his mama a new car. Oh, look, Cousin Jeffrey, he got married. Look how beautiful his wife is, you know. And all these things, you know, they turn back to you and say, so when are you going to get married? So where's my new car? Right? It banished Cousin Jeffrey. But, you know, it's like you've taken that relative or that voice or that parent or whoever, and you've brought it inside of yourself. You're the one saying the Cousin Jeffrey comparisons now for some of us. And it feeds us and it drives us. And so you have to be better. You have to be more important. You have to be more respected. You have to be better or higher ranked in, you know, in community, in work, in charity. Can't waste time. And, you know, maybe sometimes you feel like you're faking it. But if you fake it enough and enough people are impressed, then you win. But what are we really keeping score on ourselves for? See, what makes us want to keep score on ourselves? Because that just drives you crazy. It's like, it's a ridiculous idea. Why would you do this to yourself? But maybe part of it is we really do think deep down inside, if I have a high enough score, then I can love myself more. If I have a high enough score, then maybe others will respect me more. If I have a high enough score, then I'll be good enough for God. And the gospel tells you that's the exact opposite. The Bible tells us that Jesus wants to look at us and he wants to say to us, yeah, you're a sinner, but I already love you more than your points can ever rack up. You know, speaking of points and keeping score, and keeping score doesn't make a lot of sense because you can't add, you can't rack it up. So when I play basketball, rarely now, on a really good day, I can shoot one for every eight. So one basket out of every eight. That's if nobody's blocking me. And I'm even worse now than, well, maybe when I was youth, I wasn't much better either. So as a teenager, we used to play on the basketball courts on Friday nights and, you know, a lot of fun. I would be terrible by myself, but my friends weren't terrible. I had friends who were good at basketball, and this is, you know, before we had cell phones and things like that and lots of things to distract us. That's not true. We had a lot of things to distract us. We just liked basketball. So as we were playing basketball, I would, whenever I was on the team with my friends, things were good. I didn't have to keep track of my own score because my score was their score. See, my friends had this way of making me better. They would tell me, oh, go over there. Okay, pass. Okay, now shoot the ball. They would tell me what to do, and I would feel great. And at times, you know, I'd even connect up mentally and, you know, kind of go in for the layup as they're passing it to me. And, you know, I felt like a superstar. Of course, you know, I was like probably the least talented part of that team. But it felt good to play. I loved playing. And my score didn't matter. Because if you look at my score, that wasn't what the point was. The point was what everyone else's score was. And Mary gets the same thing here. She looks and says, I don't care about what I look like, my hair down. I don't care if I look like I've abandoned everything. I don't care if people don't respect me anymore. Because I'm on Team Jesus. And Judas, even though he's on Team Jesus, he's keeping his own score. He's keeping his own score, just like he's keeping track of the money, just like he's keeping track of other things. Now, there's another category where we sometimes keep score too, and this is sort of the last one. We talked about how money is there. We talked about how we look at ourselves. And the last one is, what's worth it and what's wasted with Jesus? Like, do we keep score with Jesus? It seems ridiculous because Jesus, Son of God, maker of the universe, more omnipotent than you can possibly know, how can you possibly keep score with Jesus? But there's a part of us that maybe does that. Maybe if you've been a follower of Jesus for any amount of time, or if you've just tried to follow God generally and try to be a good person, you will at some time maybe come to this moment where, God, if my family wasn't Christian, maybe there'd be some more fun things that I could do. If I wasn't a Christian, maybe, you know, there'd be some opportunities I would have had that I didn't end up getting. Or maybe I spent a lot of time praying to you, God, and asking for things, and, you know, a lot of times you just haven't answered. Maybe it's, you know, following your way, Jesus, has left me unsatisfied. Just following your way, Jesus, has, honestly, it's left me single. And maybe it's at school, you know, other students think that being a Christian is dumb. Or maybe it's you've just said no to so many different things for the sake of Jesus. You sacrifice time and everything, and somehow it doesn't seem to add up. Where am I getting back from Jesus? And maybe Judas has a little bit of that. Where am I getting back from Jesus? I've given away 3 years of my life. I don't see this going anywhere. I've given away 3 years of my life, and here I just see him sitting here with his friends, getting perfume dunked all over him. That money could have been ours, but we're not getting it. What's going to happen? Well, Judas is going to be fed up. He's going to be done. When we start thinking, what do we get back? What do we win? On the one hand, it seems like it's outrageous. You're talking the king of the universe. On the other hand, there's this part that it's normal. In any relationship, you want to feel like there's give and there's take, right? And you're happy to sacrifice to Jesus, but you got to get something back, right? That's how it feels. And maybe in this story, it starts to look that way, particularly when Mary dunks the perfume and has basically thrown her $17,000 worth of nard on Jesus. And Judas comes and berates her. And all that Jesus does is say, hey, just leave her alone. It's fine. And then pat, pat. It's okay, Mary.
Gee, thanks, Jesus. That's all we get back.
Except, you know, that's not what happened, really. Because you have to look at it in context, right? What is this whole thing in the shadow of and foreshadowing? The whole thing, as you kind of look at it, it even mentions 6 days before Passover. Passover is the time when the lambs would be sacrificed for the sins of the people of Israel, remembering how God had delivered in the past. Therefore, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Jesus had raised Lazarus already. Mary didn't need anything more from Jesus, because she had already gotten the best thing she could possibly get, at least in her view. She got Lazarus back. She got her brother back. Right? And what's about to happen? Leave her alone, verse 7, so she may keep it for the day of my burial. He foreshadows what Jesus does. So there's a what has Jesus already done for you, and there's also the what is Jesus going to do. If we follow Jesus for any reason other than following Jesus himself, if we follow Jesus to get something, maybe get somebody like you, or to have community, it ultimately will be unfulfilling. But if you follow Jesus because you put your hope in him the way that Mary does, the way that she sees he already gave her everything back. There was death and now there's life. If you look to the future and see there is a death and a payment coming for my sin, and there's a resurrection coming in the future, then you don't need something else that Jesus can give you. Because what he's given you is the best that you can possibly have. He's given you himself. Jesus is like, he's like all the best personalities of friends that you've ever had. He's like the grandma who always cooks your favorite food for you whenever they're around you, gets up at 2 a.m. and cooks it till night and then just gives it to you. Jesus is like the mom who will defend her kids, go any distance, fight anybody, go any distance, like throw over a car because of that superhuman mom strength that exists deep down inside to rescue you. Jesus is like the dad who shares all your same hobbies and understands you and listens to you and disciplines you with great gentleness but also firmness when you need it. Jesus is like the friend who, when he hears others accusing you or insulting you, he defends you and sticks up for you at his own cost, and then he doesn't tell you about it until later when you find out because he doesn't boast. Jesus is like that. Best friend, best person that you have in your life. And ultimately, that's what's wrong with keeping score, because having Jesus is about having a love relationship, which he made for you to be in. And ultimately, what's wrong with keeping score is that whether you keep score with money or about yourself, how you see yourself, or about Jesus, keeping score shuts down love. You think about it in a relationship, in a family, in anything, or with yourself. Keeping score shuts down love. And Judas cannot comprehend that love because he's keeping score. Keeping score, if you keep score in your head, your heart is closed. If you keep score, then you forfeit the ability to know what it's like to win in the realm of loving God and being loved by Jesus, being loved by him and being known by him. So as we kind of come to an end, we could talk about how we ought to be more wasteful for Jesus. It seems like maybe that would make sense if you think about, like, what can I spend this summer on? Could I just kind of waste this time instead of using it for myself? Could I waste it for Jesus so he'd be glorified? You could think about, you know, could I, you know, go be a youth worker, or could go be a missionary, or I could give up this prestigious career that I've got and use it for something that I'm not going to get anything back for. You could go that way. You could. And don't give up on those thoughts. But probably the more helpful thing to end with is really thinking about taking a look at how do we see what Jesus has done for us? Who's the one who wastes everything? Yeah, it's Mary, but it's really Jesus Who's the one who pours it all out for us because he sees us? Other people see you as worthless. Maybe you think of yourself as worthless sometimes. And you would think, why would you waste all this for me, Jesus? But he does. I want to end with one story. Just kind of gets us close a little bit to the heart of that as we kind of are doing communion today. And I'm thinking about feasts. And there's a particular feast. Some of you guys may know this short story. It's called Babette's Feast. And I paraphrase it, or I just I abbreviate real quick. Babette was a European refugee who arrived on the doorsteps of a convent in the 18th century. And she showed up in this convent that was kind of dark and gray. And the sisters who were there at first didn't want to take her because they said, we have no use for anybody like you. You could be a housekeeper, sure, but we can't pay you. So Babette insists. She stays there. She says, I don't need to be paid. Just let me stay with you. And so a refugee from war, she came from Paris. And so now she lives in this kind of dreary, drab, gray, snowy kind of place. And she stays there for 17 years, slowly earning the trust and the respect of the sisters who live there. She started to improve a little bit on their food as she could cook, and so she added some flavor to their usually bland diet. And she stayed there for 17 years, just kind of living there, and eventually became accepted by the sisters. The one thing that tied her to her previous life was that she had a lottery ticket. The lottery ticket would renew every year because there's a friend back home in Paris who would renew it for her. And so every year the numbers would be called. On the 17th year, Babette's number was called. And she won 10,000 francs. Everyone was excited for her. The sisters basically assumed, well, I guess you'll be going home soon. And so we enjoyed having you. And Babette, however, she decides, well, I'm going to throw a feast. And so she asked, well, can I cook dinner for you and some guests? And so the sisters grudgingly say, yes, it's okay, we'll accept it. And so soon she orders the food. The food starts rolling in from all over Europe, like decadent food, like certain, like ridiculously delicious mushrooms. I'm not a chef. Good stuff. And they're looking at it, and they're like, I've never seen, I don't even know what that food is. And the sisters start to get worried because they're thinking, whoa, this could be sinful. We could enjoy it too much. What do we do? And so they meet together, you know, and they start talking to them, well, what do we do? We said, yes, she could cook, but we didn't know it was going to be like this. And then so the sisters say, okay, this is what we'll do. Out of courtesy, we will eat it, but we will not enjoy it. We'll eat it, but we won't talk about it, and we'll just say thank you afterwards. And so the day arrived, and the food, she's cooked up a feast, and they're there, they're eating, and there's this one guest from town, and he's a general who was in a war in the continent of Europe, and he loves the food, and nobody else is talking about the food, of course, because the sisters had agreed they're not going to enjoy it, but the general's sitting there, and he's talking about how amazing this food is. It reminds him of the food that there was before the war in a certain cafe in Paris, and everyone loves the food deep down inside. And even though they're not talking about the food, except for that one guy, they're all bringing back memories. They're sharing jokes. They're laughing. The whole gray household has come alive and becomes filled with warmth. And so it's over. They finish. Everyone's satisfied. Everyone had a good time. And so the sisters say goodbye to Babette. And they tell Babette, well, thank you. And we will miss you. And Babette says, oh, I'm not going anywhere. And they didn't understand, well, why? Well, so that gentleman who talked about the cafe in Paris, I used to be the chef there. And in that cafe, a feast for 12 people would cost 10,000 francs. I've spent it on this meal. This is my act of appreciation for you. This is my love for you. And one of the sisters said, what a waste. Now you're going to be poor. We thought you were going to go back and go resume your old life with the lottery that you won. Why did you keep that lottery anyway? Why did you spend it all on us? And of course, for Babette, it was not a waste, but it was completely worth it because of her great love for her friends. And Jesus, even though we in and of ourselves are sinful and broken people, he comes and he says, I want to throw you the greatest feast. You are worth so much to me. Others may say you're not worthwhile. Others would say you're a waste, but I don't. I love you. And you never have to repay what I'm going to give you. And so as we kind of approach the Lord's table, we look at communion, before we even think about how we're going to give anything back to Jesus, let's bask a bit in the beauty of what Christ gave to us that was prefigured in what Mary gave to Jesus, which was what he did days later on the cross. Let's pray. Lord, we do not know our worth, either on the high end or the low end. God, we are more sinful than we can possibly imagine. And all those things that we said about Judas, though we may say his name with a spit and a scorn, we have to admit that we're sinners just like him. And our hearts are far from you many times. Many parts of our hearts, maybe all of our hearts. And Lord, your love for us, how much you value us, is greater than we could possibly imagine. Lord, the feast that you threw forth for us, the sacrifice that you made, more costly than the $17,000 perfume that Mary gave. And you poured that out for us. Lord, because of your great love for us and because of also the glory of your Father. So, Father, as we take this supper together, we pray that you remind us, what does it mean to waste in a way that is worth it when it comes to you and being close with you? In Jesus' name, amen.